Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Nair FM. My name is Cathal Brennan and I'm joined as always by my co-presenter John Dorney of theirishstory.com. On this episode we talked to Dr. Padraig Lenihan about the population of Ireland in the early modern period. Dr. Lenihan lectures in history in NUI Galway and has written a series of books on the period, most recently Consolidating Conquest, A History of Ireland, 1600-1750. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Nair FM podcast page or like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show. Welcome to the programme, Padraig.
Thanks very much.
Padraig, in the middle of our period, we're talking about roughly 1600 to 1750, there was a massive disaster, a massive fall in the Irish population. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, it's associated, John, with the Cromwellian Reconquest. Cromwell lands in Ireland in late summer of 1649 and the conquest is complete by 1653. Now, within that time period, that wartime reconquest, and that's a long and bitter reconquest, there is a massive fall in population and it's probably the single biggest demographic disaster in Irish history relative to the size of the populations, even as compared to 1740-41, which is another very severe episode, and especially compared to the Great Famine of the 1840s. So it's wartime, and I think that gives us a clue. It's a bitterly protracted war, a war in which the denial of subsistence to, if you like, guerrilla forces, the Irish are fighting and the Royalists are fighting towards the latter part, towards the latter years, a guerrilla campaign which involves raiding, intercepting garrisons, and the way, the classic way to intercept and deal with a guerrilla type campaign is to deny them foodstuffs. How do you deny them foodstuffs? I have here a quote from a Colonel Cook, Governor of Wexford, 1650. In searching the woods and bogs, we found great store of corn, which we burned, also all the houses and cabins we could find, in all of which we found plenty of corn. We continued burning and destroying for 4 days. So, as a weapon of war, or as a tactic or a stratagem of war, that's enormously destructive of agricultural resources. Lines are drawn on the map, and areas which are dominated by these Tories or guerrillas are then to be emptied of their populations, and they're to move into protected villages within the line, and no closer than, I think, a mile or two to the line. So you've got massive population movements. You've also have, famously, the movements from Leinster, Munster and Ulster to Connacht. Now, the landowning classes, a proportion of them actually move and take up their allotments in Connacht. So that's another aspect of the problem. They would bring their servants, followers, head tenants, freeholders with them. So you have, for a number of reasons, big population movements, people on the road. Take the combinations of malnourished population. They're vagrant, in effect, or living in temporary shanty towns. So those two are the classic recipes for famine diseases. And the famine diseases, the classic famine diseases, are typhus and various forms of dysenteries. Add to that cocktail plague, the bubonic plague, which breaks out in Galway in 1649, but it's the last outbreak in Ireland, and it lasts until maybe 1652, 1653, and you take that lethal mix of diseases and malnutrition, and you have the circumstances. You can see why so many people will have died either directly as a result of military activity, or one could argue indirectly as a result of the bitterness of the reconquest.
Mm-hmm. And how severe, in terms of numbers, was this catastrophe, or do we know at all?
Well, William Petty classically came up with figures, which I'm not going to give you, because I don't believe it is much to be gained by citing Petty's actual statistics. I mean, he bases his population statistics on cattle exports through some convoluted means of political arithmetic. But what is important, I think, is that the percentage fall that he reckons happened between, say, 1641 and 1652 was a 42%.
Mm, massive.
I don't believe that. I would put it at around 20%. And I looked at They looked at several case studies. I've looked at population profiles. You see, how do I explain this? The Cromwellians are great for keeping records. So you have records of fairly substantial swathes of the population. As, for example, in South County Dublin, which is within a line, if you like, and outside of the line is unprotected Wicklow, North Wexford, and indeed parts of South County Dublin. So that if you want to control movements of people across the line, you need to have accurate descriptions, house by house, who's living there, what they look like, what their height is, what their appearance is, what their age is. And I looked at these, and I broke down the age distribution, and I found it was rather strange. It was like pre-modern populations, the age pyramid or profile is a pyramid. It's pyramidical. In other words, it's a broad base. 0 to 10, the age group 0 to 10 forms the base. The teenage years 10 to 20. So narrower, 20s, 30s, getting narrower all the time. So you have a triangle with an apex coming to a sharp point. It's as if in these samples, the upper part of the triangle has been swept away. Mm. It's almost, instead of a gradual tapering, it's practically disappearing. Certainly when you look at the older age cohort, they're gone. And that is suggestive of, given that they're most vulnerable along with the younger, the preteens, it suggests a fairly significant, very significant dieback. My own figures, I came up with, as I say, an estimate of about one-fifth. Willie Smith now, in his map-making landscapes and memory, is quite critical of that. He thinks he would go up as high as a third. And again, I think he and others make the mistake of getting into absolute figures and adding and subtracting. There are no head counts. If I could digress for a moment to explain how difficult and how uncertain the business is. If you're looking at an estimate of population post-war, you're looking at something called the so-called census, which is in fact a poll tax return, a poll tax or a head tax. And you have these for most counties in Ireland for 1659. Whoop-de-doo, you might say, haven't we got something to go on? No, because it doesn't tell you how many people were not enrolled for tax at all. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you taxes is by how many people each head of household represents. What's your multiplier? Is it 4? Is it 5? Is it 6? Is it 7? And if you can imagine the disputes between those, or the differences between those multipliers, can give you wildly varying figures. So it's an uncertain business, and ultimately it's impressionistic. So I'm leaving with the impression that it was the worst demographic catastrophe in early modern or modern Irish history, but I can't actually be certain about that.
Porrick, if we were to talk about immigration into Ireland in the early modern period up to maybe the Williamite period, looking at the various plantations, how accurate are the figures for people immigrating into Ireland?
They are more accurate because the principle, if you take something like the plantation of Ulster, one of the conditions for a grant is that each undertaker plants, and I haven't got the figure at the top of my head, let's say there's 20 families per allotment of 1,000 acres or something. It may be something different now, but that's, if you like, that's the principle involved. So to ensure compliance with the various conditions under which the undertakers are granted these lands, inspectors come along in succeeding years and they literally count the number of people. They have musters and to check that they've got weapons. So you then have lists of men, adult men, for the settler population in Ulster. And with that as your basis, you can then extrapolate. Adult men represent maybe 40%, 30-40% of the of early modern populations. So you've got a fairly useful multiplier, and you can then extrapolate from that. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at a ballpark figure, maybe 100,000 settlers in Ireland by 1640, 100,000 people rather, of settler, first generation or second generation settlers, English and Scots, Scots more numerous in Ulster, plantation of Munster, again attracting overwhelmingly English settlers. So as to the relative distribution, most disproportionately they would have been those 100,000, maybe half to 60,000, 50 to 60,000 would be in Ulster and the remainder in the rest of the country.
Now, Pádraic, if we were looking at 1641 and the rebellion in Ulster, one of the issues was the distortion of figures relating to how many Protestant civilians were killed during that rebellion. How did that affect people's idea of the population at the time?
It didn't particularly. Now, it's terribly important, the black legend, as it were, of an overwhelming massacre, the worst that the sun ever beheld, and so on. That is terribly important in motivating English public opinion against the king initially, King Charles, whom the parliamentarians taint as being allied to these barbarous wretches, and later on it's used, for instance, by Cromwell at Drogheda, where he talks about revenge against those who have imbrued their hands in so much blood. The question you posed, statistically, various figures are thrown out about how many were killed in the Catholic and Protestant massacres in the autumn, winter, and early spring of 1640 to 1641, figures ranging from 200,000 to 400,000. Mainly, they originated with a man named Henry Jones, a bishop of Clogher, and later on, people like Milton, the poet and propagandist for Cromwell, comes up with figures. And again, they're not that important, the figures in themselves. They're just used as a way of conveying the enormity of what happened. I mean, most of the figures exceed the number of Protestants in the country, full stop, right? So having said that, when you do a statistical analysis, as Hilary Sims has done, for example, for County Armagh, and she looks at the depositions, these are the statements from the victims, and eliminates double counting and hearsay, and tries to figure out how many people were actually killed and what proportion that represents of the settler population in County Armagh, you are looking at a significant impact locally. In Armagh, which is probably the worst affected county in that respect, in that you have maybe 15% of the population fall victim. So that's a significant event. Likewise, in the same period, or slightly afterwards, into the summer of 1642, you have a series of, if you like, Protestant and Catholic massacres, which are at least as numerous, and are mainly to be found on the fringes of the Pale, and to some extent in Cork as well. And that's probably the worst episode of direct killing or violence in the entire period of the wars from 1641 up to 1653.
Another question on settlers: when people think of a Scottish settlement, particularly in Ireland, they automatically think of the Ulster Plantation. But in fact, if you read in your book, for example, Consolidating Conquest, you see that the greatest Scottish migration was in the 1690s.
That's right. That's one that's not particular. That, it is that which gives, I think, Northern Ireland its distinctive character. I mean, when we think about the six planted counties of the Plantation of Ulster, Donegal and Cavan are located in the Republic, in the modern day Republic or the Free State or whatever, in the 26 counties. So therefore, Antrim and Down were not subject to an official government-sponsored plantation as such. They are exposed to private plantation, or they experience private plantation and massive immigration to what's called the Lordship of Clandeboy, which would have been North County Down, South County Antrim. And from that basis, in the later 1690s, where the mid to late 1690s, when Scotland experiences, well, all of Western Europe experiences climate-related famine or privation or food shortages, Ireland is rather less affected than most other countries, and there's a sort of a pull factor there. So in those decades, there's massive Scottish migration into Ulster, so that Antrim Down and County Derry in particular experience that, and that shifts the balance of population within Ulster decisively in favour of settler over native, or newcomer over native.
So immigration is some of the story of the recovery of the Irish population after the disasters of the mid-17th century, but there are clearly other things going on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, certainly, assuming, and these are, I said at the beginning I wouldn't use round figures, right? Mm-hmm. But I will. Having said that, if you say, right, at the beginning of, in 1600, the population of Ireland might have been just a little bit south of a million people. So we'll say a million to be on the, and it's somewhat less than 2 million by 1700. So if you just take the figures, one million, so you're looking at 1 to 2 million, you're looking at a 100% increase over the 17th century. Now, in round terms, allowing for, okay, so there's mass immigration into Ireland, but there's also mass out-migration. I mean, if you look at the figures, in the post-Cromwellian conquest period, something like 35,000 soldiers, military men, migrated to France and Spain to take part in and be consumed by the latter years of the continuation of the 30 Years' War, the Franco-Spanish or Bourbon-Habsburg struggle. And they brought with them camp followers, wives, girlfriends, children. You're looking at other movements of a single or unattached children or vagrant children to the West Indies. So you're looking at out-migration, which at least, I think, cancels out, equals in-migration. And mm-hmm. I'm really chancing my arm here. But notwithstanding that, the net effect of in-migration and out-migration is probably balance each other out. But notwithstanding that, population increases significantly, with doubles over that century, notwithstanding a demographic catastrophe at its centre. And you have to wonder why. And the reason is, it's got to be a very healthy rate of natural increase in population. Now, what do I mean by natural, the natural rate of increase? It's the excessive births over deaths. The global figure there, if you're looking at a population increase of 1% a year, which is what's happening in Ireland. Now, that's, by modern standards, if you like, if you look at the, what we would have called, I don't know, the developing world or the third world or whatever, that's not particularly rapid. I mean, the Philippines, for example, I was just looking at this in the context of the recent tsunami. The Philippines has a population growth rate of 2.36, I think, 2.36 per annum. So it's, you know, it's not as rapid as that, but it's still quite rapid. Why is there an increase, and why does that happen, that natural buoyancy in the population? It has to do with the preventative check as opposed to the positive check. Now, what do we mean by that? In Northwest Europe, in countries that have, like Holland or England, where the returns on agriculture are not as abysmally poor as they are elsewhere in Europe, where there's some degree of market integration, the transport network, canals, roads, is reasonable by contemporary standards, you tend to have a demographic behaviour which you could describe as the preventative check. In other words, people, and women particularly, it matters greatly what age young women marry at. And in those countries, the age at which young women get married, or are married, responds, albeit after a lag and indirectly, to perceived economic opportunities. So that, in other words, in economic bad times, there's a tendency for marriage to be postponed. Marriage postponement means that a woman might be postponing marriage during a year or two when she's at her most fertile, so that, if you like, that limits the number of children born in the longer run. Remember, we're not talking about artificial contraception. This is just not on. So that the age of marriage of women is the key variable here. Mm-hmm. That's the preventative check. The positive check is where that doesn't happen. And this is true over most of Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean, Ireland, where women marry at a younger age. And I think this statistical evidence is clear that there is a difference, different demographic behaviour. Statistical evidence from the middle of the 17th century would show that women marry on average 2 years younger than their English counterparts, which implies about 5 births per marriage as opposed to about 4 in England at the time. And a lot of the impressionistic evidence reinforces that. Oliver Cromwell himself remarks, the poorer sort of Irish in Ireland do as well as the rich abound in children. And for him that's strange, because in his society it's the wealthy have the bigger families, the poor people have smaller families. That doesn't hold here. That means you've got a buoyancy in birth rates, a natural increase. But that then hits the what is the positive check? The positive check happens when that buoyancy hits the ceiling that's fixed by the capacity of that society to produce food or to transport a food surplus from one part of the country to the other, or to provide work whereby people can buy that food. There's a number of constraints. That's what we mean by the Malthusian or positive check. So you've got this natural buoyancy in population, this natural increase that hits against the ceiling, notably in the 1650s. And I'm not discounting the element of artifice or the man-made contribution here, and again in the 1740s.
What was the role of the potato? The potato arrived in the late 17th century, was it, in Ireland?
Yes, it begins its long march probably in the dairying regions of Munster. The role of the potato is that it's a cheap and abundant foodstuff. If you're producing foodstuff for the market, let's say butter later on, or cereals, butter or cereals or something like that, these commodities are simply too valuable to be, so to speak, wasted by being eaten by the people who are producing them. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the potato is a cheap and abundant foodstuff whereby the producers of the cereals or the butter or whatever can predominantly or largely can supplement their diet by eating the potato, whereby they're not eating from the foodstuffs that are produced, that are going to market. So it's associated with commercialized as opposed to subsistence agriculture. It's associated with initially with those parts of the country which are producing a food surplus. Well, I mean, the very earliest indications, it's an exotic garden crop. You see, the depositions refer to them. It seems to have undergone a modest spread in wartime, possibly because potatoes are less vulnerable to destruction than, say, cereal crops. So we're looking at a crop that begins in Munster, the dairying regions of Munster, and spreads from there quite slowly now. We know the initial association is with the dairying districts because very often, the visitors talk about their dearly beloved Bonnie Clobber and potatoes. Bonnie Clobber is a mess, or it's a sort of buttermilk in the form of milk. That is often associated with potatoes. So I suppose that there's a link there between the dairying and potatoes. So it begins there in the 1670s, it's established there as a short-term, as a seasonal and class-based food supplement. What do I mean by that? In dairying districts, as opposed to tillage districts of Ireland, the hungry months are in the winter, when cows dry up, when grass isn't growing anymore. And the potato finds its niche, as it were, as a supplement, as a stopgap during those hungry months. I mean, the hungry months in a tillage or cereal growing area would be when summer, the height of summer rather, just before the cereal harvest begins. So hence you'd have July, ool and kabosh, or July of the cabbages, where you have supplementary foods like potatoes and cabbages become quite important. Now, the potato then starts out as a supplementary foodstuff, used for a short time during the year and used by a particular class of people. So it's a wintertime diet, and it's associated mostly with the poor people, with the poor, and we see that in contemporary references. The earliest evidence of the widespread adaptation of it comes from the Williamite Wars, where you have foreign officers recording their impressions, be they French or Danes, and we see from this they spend one winter in Ulster, 1689-90, and another in Munster, 1690-91, and there are far more frequent references to, as one Dane says, ert, ert apples, or pommes de terre, the potato, as something that they've noticed much more in Munster. It's only a decade or so that practice has been in place. So the potato gradually increases in importance, but up to the 1740s, it's a supplementary food peculiar to some parts of the country and to the poorer classes of the labouring population. And it's partly implicated, of course, in the famine of 1740-41 as well.
Yes, I was just going to come to that, Pádraig. as you've already mentioned, Charles Malthus and his theories of population in pre-industrial societies, where basically population reaches a ceiling and then there's a famine because it can't sustain it. And is that what happened in Ireland in 1741 in the Great Famine of that year?
It's to do with freakishly cold weather. And again, we're looking at the period generally from the late, from 1600 up to the mid-1700s is one of, that's often referred to as the Little Ice Age. You might have heard the phrase where there was a global cooling, and why that happened, whether it's sunspot activity or for whatever reason, it was a fact. So if you can imagine an agricultural economy where returns on cereal crops, for example, are miserably low. You're looking at, you know, maybe three or four grains being produced for every grain sown. So the margins are tight. And then if you have severe weather on top of that, it cuts in on the harvest. And what you have in 1740-41 was very severe, very freakishly cold weather. I mean, in mid-January 1741, people could walk across Loch Ness on the ice. That's 10 miles. They could bring animals and carts, and they could walk from Antrim over to County Tyrone, or rather vice versa. That severe frost happens in the wintertime. It destroys the potatoes. If you're anybody from a farming background will know that when you're storing potatoes, you camp them, you cover them. I don't know what to do now, but you camp them, you put straw or some insulating material over them, and soil over that again. That's to protect them against frost, because if the frost gets at them, they're inedible. And that seems to have happened in Munster. But we're looking at something as a perfect storm. You have animals dying in the field of the cold. Then you have drought in spring. So tillage crops sown the previous autumn were largely destroyed in many districts. You have a famine that peaks from 1740 into 41. It peaks in 1741. The spring of 1741, you've got bloody flux or dysentery, which is a classic famine disease, obviously, and typhus, likewise, another classic disease of famine conditions. Now, those diseases, the dysentery or bloody flux is so called because, without disgusting your listeners, stools are blood red. And the typhus is a disease borne by the human louse. It's a disease of armies, encampments, workhouses, hospitals, jails. It's often called jail fever, camp fever, sometimes unflatteringly Irish fever or Irish ague. It's associated with these conditions whereby you have the poor, hungry, malnourished, and, if you like, are huddled together, maybe in particularly cold weather and in close proximity, and the louse then transfers the disease from one person to the other, and it's quite deadly, quite severe. Give the famine fevers, you have outright hunger, and again we're stuck with the situation of estimated death rates. Mm-hmm. Contemporaries talk about anything from a third to a half of the labouring people or cottiers. Let's not worry so much about the fraction. The assumption is that mortality is class specific. It's the labouring people or cottagers or cottiers are suffering most. Cormac Grauda now, and David Dixon has written about this and this particular famine, the unknown famine as it were, and Cormac Grauda's book on famine attempts a percentage, an estimated death rate in percentage terms from selected famines, and he includes the 1740-41, and he comes up with a death rate, or he estimates one of 13%, which is in excess of, marginally so, of the Great Famine of 1846 to 52. That's of 12%. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at, in relative terms, it's marginally more severe than the Great Famine. And how does that compare in relative terms? Both of those are severe famines. If you take the famine in France in the mid, remember I said in the mid 1690s, mm-hmm, there were severe conditions across Western Europe. France has a famine, a devastating famine, which accounts for maybe 7% of the population. Famine in Finland in 1868, 7% of the population. The more contemporary comparisons, the famine associated with Stalin's collectivization policy, mm-hmm, in the Ukraine in the early 1930s accounted for 4% of the population. So you're looking at episodes in Irish history that are devastatingly, in relative terms,
disastrous. Yeah,
disastrous. Yeah. The difficulty, of course, is
Porrick, can you talk about some of the parallels to modern third world population issues or famine with this period?
I think we should be careful about making parallels, because we're now in a period since the Industrial Revolution. I mean, population growth from the mid-19th century in Western Europe and maybe mid-20th century globally just have gone into a vertical takeoff. And in that sense, what's happened is really without precedent. So the periods I'm talking about, you're looking at population that is, to some extent, regulated or regulating itself either by the preventative or positive check. Whereas what's happened in globally, I suppose, since beginning in the mid-19th century, is the so-called demographic transition. You have falling death rates, laterally, after a gap in Europe, certainly in North America, falling birth rates. But in between those two events, huge rates of natural increase. And worldwide, we're still, in most countries, we're still sub-Saharan Africa, many countries in Asia, are still at that phase of falling death rates, but no corresponding fall in birth rates, which may or may not follow. It certainly did in Europe and North America in the 20th century. I mean, that followed, and it probably will follow worldwide. So you're looking at a different situation. I wouldn't care to make comparisons between pre-modern and modern demographic dynamics.
Okay, Porrick, I think it was very interesting, and thank you very much for your time. This
Thanks
was John Dorney and
Cathal Brennan, and thank you very much for listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, check us out on the Near FM podcast page or go to our Facebook page on www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show.